it's time for the Des Moines Register on Thursday, March 7. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. My name is Twyla Glenn, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Linda Lundgren. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinion, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at the weather and headlines from today's Des Moines Register. According to AccuWeather, across the state, we'll see cloudy and mild temperatures today with occasional rain in the afternoon. Winds east 7 to 14 miles per hour. Periods of rain tonight with winds northeast 10 to 20 miles per hour. Looking at the forecast through the weekend for central Iowa, we see that today and tonight we'll have a high of 56 and a low of 38. Should be mild today with periods of rain late in the afternoon, winds east 7 to 14 miles per hour, and periods of rain tonight. On Friday, a touch of morning rain with a high of 43 and a low of 27. On Saturday, sunshine and breezy with a high of 48 and a low of 29. And on Sunday, should be sunny and milder with a high of 58 and a low of 39. Tracking precipitation in the 24 hours through 4 p.m. Wednesday, we had 0 inches. Our month to date has been 0.1. That's 0.01, that's 1/100th of an inch, against a normal of 36/100ths of an inch. Our year-to-date normal precipitation is 2.84, but this year we've seen just, I turn that around. Our year-to-date has been 2, I really messed this up, didn't I? Sorry about that. Year-to-date, we have had 2.34 hundredths of an inch precipitation. Our normal for this date for the year would be 2.84 hundredths of an inch. Last year we had had 3.66 inches. We're still tracking snowfall in the 24 hours through 4 p.m. Wednesday. There was zero, and the month to date has been zero. Normal for this month to date is 1.3 inches, and our season to date has been 34.2 inches. Our normal season to date is 32.3 inches. Sunrise today was at 6:39 a.m., sunset tonight at 6:13 p.m. Moonrise today, 5:25 a.m., with moonset tonight at 2:40, moonset today rather, at 2:54 p.m. Well, I hope you got something out of the weather that I scrambled like that. Turning now to the front page of the Des Moines Register, there is a fairly good-sized picture on the front page titled Ankeny Moves On, and the picture shows Ankeny's it's a basketball, a boys' basketball game in Wells Fargo Arena. And it shows Ankeny's Carson Johnson, who scored a game-high 26 points in a 60-47 win over Dubuque Senior yesterday. On Wednesday. That was yesterday. The victory earned the Hawks a trip to Thursday's state semifinal game, where they will take on top-ranked Cedar Rapids Kennedy. And they'll have more coverage of the boys' basketball tournament when we hear sports in the second shift. The headlines for today on the Des Moines Register's front page read like this: Iowa Senate okays immigration bill to make it illegal reentry state crime. And an Iowa Poll Register exclusive. The headline reads, most Iowans favor getting rid of the state income tax. And now, here with our first story is Linda.
Well, I'll read the story about the state income tax. It says majorities say they prefer a gradual elimination. By a 2-to-1 margin, Iowans favor gradually reducing the state's income tax until it is eliminated, a new Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll finds. The poll shows a majority of Iowans support Governor Kim Reynolds and Republicans in the Iowa legislature as they discuss ways to lower the income tax or do away with it completely. 62% of Iowans say they favor gradually eliminating the income tax, while 30% oppose eliminating the tax, and 8% are not sure. The poll shows a partisan split on the issue. Nearly three-quarters of Iowa Republicans, or 74%, favor eliminating the income tax, compared with 63% of political independents and 42% of Democrats. Meanwhile, a plurality of Democrats oppose eliminating the income tax, which stands at 44%, compared with one-third of independents, 33%, and one-fifth of Republicans at 20%. The poll of 804 Iowa adults was conducted February 2020. It has a margin of error of plus or minus 3.5 percentage points. Carla Sams, a 64-year-old poll respondent from Anamosa who agreed to a follow-up interview, said getting rid of the income tax would help people who are struggling with the cost of groceries and other goods. If there's a way to get rid of the state income tax that is fiscally responsible without raising everything else, like property taxes and that kind of stuff, I would be for it, she said. Still, Sam said she doesn't want to see state programs cut as a result. They would have to make sure their ducks are in a row and whatever state programs that we have stay before they got rid of the state income tax, she said. Support for eliminating the income tax has grown since the last time the Iowa poll tested the issue in March of 2023. That poll found 56% of Iowans favored eliminating the tax, while 33% opposed it and 11% were not sure. Republicans who control the House, Senate, and governor's office are looking at different options for cutting income taxes this year. Reynolds has proposed speeding up and deepening a series of income tax cuts passed in 2022. Her proposal would take Iowa to a flat income tax rate of 3.65% this year and 3.5% next year. The Republican chairs of the House and Senate Ways and Means Committees, who handle tax legislation, have proposed a gradual phase-out of the state's individual income tax by creating an Iowa Taxpayer Relief Trust with surplus funds and using the money to ratchet down the income tax rate over time. Reynolds has said previously that she supports eliminating the income tax and hopes to do so by the end of her current term in office in January 2027. Democrats and other critics have warned that eliminating the income tax could result in sales tax or property tax increases and will mean cuts to government services that Iowans rely on. That's a concern for Sheila Doherty, a 56-year-old poll respondent from Sac City, who works part-time for a wildlife rehabilitation organization. Doherty, a political independent who receives Social Security disability benefits, said lawmakers need to focus on the needs that the state has. We're having trouble enough funding important government projects, she said, and taking away even more money just is not going to be the answer for that. A little side information about the Iowa poll. This poll was conducted February 25th to 28th, and it's for the Register and MediaCom by Selzer and Company. It's based on telephone interviews with 804 Iowans who are age 18 and older. The households are randomly selected, and it's both landline and cell phone numbers. The interviews are administered in English, and the responses are adjusted by age, sex, and congressional district to reflect the general population based on American Community Survey estimates. The questions have a maximum margin of error of plus or minus 3.5 percentage points. Now, this means that if the survey were repeated using the same questions and the same methodology 19 times out of 20, the findings would not vary from the true population value by more than plus or minus 3.5 percentage points. The results are based on smaller samples of respondents, such as by gender or age. It says based on smaller samples based on gender and age would have a larger margin of error.
Iowa Senate okays immigration bill to make illegal entry, that's a quote from the bill, a state crime. The Iowa Senate voted Thursday to make it a crime for someone to attempt to enter Iowa after previously being deported or denied entry into the United States, passing a bill modeled after the Texas law that is tied up in court. The Senate voted 34-16 Tuesday to pass Senate File 2340, with every Republican in favor and every Democrat opposed. The vote sends the bill to the Iowa House, which has passed its own version of the legislation through committee. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito temporarily halted enforcement of a similar law in Texas on Monday while the court considers a legal challenge. The plaintiffs argue that the state law unconstitutionally bypasses the federal government's authority to enforce immigration laws and could create what the filers call chaos. Senator Jeff Reichman, a Republican of Montrose, said he took an oath as a Marine Corps officer and a senator to protect and defend the U.S. Constitution. What is unconstitutional is the way that our federal government is abdicating their duties, he said. They refuse to enforce the law, he said. Senator Janice Weiner, a Democrat of Iowa City, said it is the job of the federal government to pass immigration laws, not states. She pointed to a bill that failed to pass the U.S. Senate last month that would have created a new mechanism to shut down the border if illegal crossings reach a certain threshold. There's a solution out there, colleagues, she said. A tough bipartisan compromise bill was hammered out in the U.S. Senate. It is supported by the U.S. Border Patrol Union, the very folks who would be responsible for enforcing it, she said. The bill creates a new crime of illegal entry into the state. In most cases, the crime would be an aggravated misdemeanor, which carries a 2-year sentence, but it would rise to a Class D felony, punishable by up to 5 years in prison in certain circumstances. And the crime would become a Class C felony, punishable by up to 10 years in prison if the person was arrested for allegedly committing another felony. For anyone convicted of illegal reentry, the judge in the case would have to enter an order requiring the convicted person to return to the country they had come from. Weiner said Iowa's only international port of entry is the Des Moines International Airport and asked Republicans who would be responsible for ensuring the person leaves the country after being sentenced. This is a political stunt and a false promise that does not contain the needed resources, she said. It's a gotcha bill, she said. The bill forbids law enforcement officers from arresting someone if the person is in a school, a place of worship, a health care facility, or a facility for survivors of sexual assault. And the legislation provides legal immunity for local law enforcement and other government officials responsible for enforcing the measure. The House has passed its own version of the bill out of committee, but has yet to take it up on the floor. Representative Stephen Holt, a Republican of Denison, who chairs the House Judiciary Committee, said he's watching the legal developments in the Texas case, but said he wants Iowa to do what he called push the envelope. We understand some of the things we do might be challenged constitutionally, he said. But when you've got a federal government that's refusing to enforce immigration law on the border, we think the states have a sovereign right to defend themselves. This legislation is one of several bills Republicans are considering this year that proponents say would help deter illegal immigration, but critics have described as anti-immigrant. Last week, the Senate voted 30-17 to pass a bill requiring all Iowa businesses to use the federal E-Verify system to determine whether their employees are legally in the country. Companies that violate the requirement would face the suspension or loss of their business license.
Okay, we'll turn now to the Metro section. Caldwell Johnson resigns from the DMPS board. The 18-year member has been battling health issues. The longest-serving board member for the Des Moines Public Schools, Terry Caldwell Johnson, who has been battling cancer, has resigned after nearly two decades. School Board Chair Jackie Norris confirmed Tuesday afternoon that Caldwell Johnson, who has been on the board since 2006, has submitted her resignation. Caldwell Johnson has also pulled back from her role as CEO at Oak Ridge Neighborhood, a Des Moines nonprofit that provides services such as housing for families in need, to focus on her health, according to a news release. Caldwell Johnson, who served multiple times as school board chair or vice chair over the years, announced last year she had been diagnosed with cancer. In recent months, she has attended school board meetings online. Board members dressed in shades of green Tuesday night in honor of Caldwell Johnson's favorite color, Kelly Green. While she did not attend the board meeting, several people said she was watching online. "It has been my privilege to have been elected to serve on the Des Moines Public School Board over the past 18 years, Caldwell Johnson wrote in her resignation letter, "and my greatest honor is to have served as the board chair. Our district's commitment to student outcomes and policy-focused governance has created a win-win for our district and our current and future students. It is her expectation that this will continue under Superintendent Ian Roberts and the board's leadership," she said. Both past and present board members spoke during the meeting about Caldwell Johnson's style, insight around education, and her many contributions to the district and community. Roberts told those gathered that he spent time with Caldwell Johnson on Saturday. "During 2 hours or more of conversation, you continuously asked how you can be helpful to me," he said of Caldwell Johnson. "You shared so many nuggets of wisdom during that time that no amount of schooling or life experiences will ever be able to replace those. I will continue to keep those near and dear as I lead and serve this amazing school system." Caldwell Johnson has always been a person who does not mince words, said former board chair Duana Bradley. "It was a blessing for me to be able to sit down with her. The amount of style and grace that she shows, her strength, and I think you can all agree with me that when Terry spoke, we listened," Bradley said. Caldwell Johnson's time on the board has been marked with two national superintendent searches and the COVID-19 pandemic. Caldwell Johnson was part of the superintendent search for former Superintendent Nancy Sebring's replacement, and later longtime Superintendent Tom Ahart's replacement, said Phil Rader, district spokesperson. In total, she has helped oversee three superintendents and one interim superintendent. Ahart also served as interim superintendent for a year after Sebring resigned. Most recently, Caldwell Johnson and the board hired Roberts to oversee Iowa's largest and most diverse school district. At the height of the pandemic, Des Moines schools, and in particular, Ahart, came under fire for the board's decision to have students start the 2020-21 school year online. Board members said at the time Ahart was just following their orders. The superintendent later received a written reprimand from the Iowa Board of Educational Examiners for the move. Caldwell Johnson has also been known not to back down from controversy. During the district's State of the Schools address in February 2023, Caldwell Johnson asked lawmakers to leave our public schools alone in response to a question about what legislators can do to help schools besides an increase of funds. "We don't need your interventions around curriculum, what we teach, how we teach, who we teach, and Des Moines Public Schools has been in existence for 116 years, and we've been doing pretty darn well," she said at the time. During her final full year on the board, Caldwell Johnson was instrumental in the search for Roberts and helping to build a relationship between Des Moines Schools and Drake University during construction of the shared stadium, Rader said. During the 2018-19 school year, district leaders met with community members to discuss a number of issues impacting Des Moines Public Schools. Out of those conversations came the district and board's commitment to improve academic outcomes for Black male students, particularly in the areas of math and reading. Board member Kim Martorano noted Caldwell Johnson tirelessly championed for marginalized communities and the empowerment of Black males in our district. "Your unwavering commitment to addressing the unique challenges faced by this demographic group has been nothing short of inspirational," Martorano said. "Through your leadership, you have sparked meaningful conversations, implemented targeted initiatives, and pave the way for a more inclusive and equitable educational experience for all students." While the district has struggled to make some of these goals, Caldwell Johnson has continued to advocate for students. Caldwell Johnson, the daughter of educators, summed up her reason for running for the board in a video the board showed from her time with the district. "I ran understanding that kids that are in need and live in impoverished neighborhoods need a voice, and so I decided that I wanted to be the voice for our little brown and Black children," she said in the clip. Since 2004, Caldwell Johnson has served as the CEO of Oak Ridge Neighborhood. She has also sat on several nonprofit boards, including the Mid-Iowa Health Foundation, Greater Des Moines Community Foundation, Planned Parenthood, and Spelman College Museum of Fine Art. In an emailed statement, officials at Oak Ridge said Caldwell Johnson transitioned out of her day-to-day responsibilities at the nonprofit to prioritize her health. They also thanked Caldwell Johnson for her years of dedication to fulfilling the organization's mission. "Speaking on behalf of our entire team, Terry is a dear friend, a wonderful mentor, and one that brings the secret sauce to make Oak Ridge Neighborhood such an inspiring place," said spokesperson Chris Irvine in a statement. "We are so thankful for her, her guidance, and her example. Because of her and the strong legacy she has built, we know Oak Ridge Neighborhood will continue to thrive in supporting children and families as it has for the last 55 years. The board of directors has selected Kristen Clayton, Vice President of Finance and Administration, to take on Caldwell Johnson's role as acting CEO. Over the years, Caldwell Johnson has been widely recognized for her work in the community, strong faith, and leadership. She is the 2024 recipient of the state's Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Achievement Award. Last year, she was awarded the Christine Wilson Medal for Equality and Justice and the President's Volunteer Service Lifetime Achievement Award. She was also named a 2022 Remarkable Woman by WHO-TV's Next Star Media Group. Caldwell Johnson was nicknamed the Mayor of Oak Ridge by State Representative Ako Abdul-Samad for her work in the community. Abdul-Samad previously served on the board. To honor Caldwell Johnson, Abdul-Samad announced she was receiving a certificate of recognition from the State House of Representatives for her long-lasting positive impact on the students of Des Moines Community School District, the community of Des Moines, and the state of Iowa. Terry, you've always been the shoulders a lot of us have stood on, and you have been an inspiration to a lot of us when we got down and thought there was nowhere to go, said Abdul-Samad.
More downtown housing. The Financial Center, a 25-story downtown skyscraper that once was Iowa's tallest, is slated to soon join downtown Des Moines' growing list of office towers converted into residential buildings following City Council approval of the amended development agreement on Monday. It's part of a growing trend locally and nationwide. Plagued with an elevated office vacancy rate since the 2020 onset of the COVID-19 pandemic, landlords and developers have looked to turn their empty offices into homes. The conversions hold the potential to stop the erosion of a crucial tax base while addressing a national housing shortage. The White House is looking to support similar projects so far with mixed success. In Des Moines, conversions began years earlier as a booming downtown population brought new opportunities to the owners of aging office buildings. It's a bad thing for the community to have too many older buildings sitting empty, Jim Hubble, head of his family's real estate empire, told the Register in 2003. If we start talking and get the ball rolling, things will happen, he added. Here are some of the most visible of the conversion projects. First, the Hubble Tower. Among the first conversions was the Hubble Building, the historic former home of Hubble Realty, converted into apartments in 2006 using a combination of historic and low-income housing tax credits. It was later rebranded as the Hubble Tower. The 10-story building at 904 Walnut Street was built in 1913 by its namesake and one of Des Moines' early builders, F.M. Hubble. It was designed by Proudfoot and Bird, the architectural firm responsible for some of Des Moines' signature structures, including the Equitable Building and the Des Moines City Hall. The Hubble Building housed Hubble Realty Company's corporate offices until the firm moved to its current West Des Moines campus at 6900 Westtown Parkway in 2002. The downtown building was sold for $3.2 million in 2022 to a New York company listed as Hubble Financial LLC. Hubble Tower now has 73 apartment units. Next, the Des Moines Building. The former office building at 405 6th Avenue, once abandoned, got a residential makeover in 2013 after the city of Des Moines claimed the property. Constructed in 1930, the 14-story structure, like the Hubble Tower, was designed by Proudfoot and Bird. The former owner shut off the building's boilers in 2010, and by the time the city intervened on December 10 of that year, the structure was hours away from freezing, according to the Des Moines Register archives. City officials said the situation could have led to major flooding and fire hazards. In May of 2011, the building was declared a public nuisance. That November, the city sold the building for $150,000 to Des Moines Apartments LP, which spearheaded its redevelopment as a residential structure. The building has 136 apartments. Next on the list is the Equitable. The 19-story Equitable building was constructed in 1923 to house the Equitable of Iowa Insurance Company, founded by F.M. Hubbell, and remained Iowa's tallest skyscraper for a half a century until the Financial Center's construction. It was converted to apartments in 2016. The project was already in talks in 2003, and the late real estate developer Bob Knapp began renovating the building into condos in the mid-2000s. But before he could finish, he was accused of illegal asbestos removal and was later sentenced to more than 3 years in federal prison. Kansas City-based developer Fouch Brothers eventually completed renovation of the 19-story building. It paid just $460,000 for the structure in 2012. Renamed the Equitable, it now houses 146 high-end units. The R&T Lofts. The former Des Moines Register building at 717 Locust Street found a new life in 2017 after nearly a century as the publishing hub of the newspaper, which moved to Capitol Square in 2013. The 13-story Register building opened in 1918. A four-story addition was built in 1947. Indianapolis-based TWG Development took on the challenging project after at least two other development groups had the building under contract and failed to close. Covering half a city block, the building's wide footprint made it difficult to build apartments with window access, so every single floor plan had to be unique. The building is now home to 164 loft units. Next, looking at 2 Ruan Center. 2 Ruan Center, a landmark Des Moines office building at 601 Locust Street, could be the newest conversion in downtown Des Moines. Built in 1981 with 250,556 square feet of finished floor space, it initially was known as the Carriers Building and housed the Ruan Family Carriers Insurance Company. The 14-story building name was changed in 1986 after Carriers closed. The redevelopment of the office building, now largely vacant, was announced in September. Partnering with Ruan on the project will be Block Real Estate Services and Fouch Brothers, the same two companies that led the 2016 conversion of the Equitable directly across Locust Street from 2 Ruan. Construction is expected to begin in late 2024, with units becoming available in 2025 and 26, a representative of the project said. The building will have 200 market-rate apartments. Next, the Financial Center. The latest office-to-residential conversion to be announced, the Financial Center, could soon convert more than half its floors to residential use. The 25-story skyscraper at 666 Walnut Street was built for two competing banking institutions in 1973 and was the tallest in Iowa until the construction of the Ruan Center in 1975. The Financial Center's owner, Landmark Capital, Inc., brought it in 2014 and proposed converting the first 13 floors for an upscale hotel 6 years later. As market conditions for the development of hotels changed over the course of the COVID-19 pandemic, so did the project. Under an amendment to a development agreement with the city, construction would begin on or before September 30 and be completed by the end of April 2026. Terms of the 2020 agreement included a 15-year tax increment financing packaging totaling $7.5 million. The conversion would bring 190 units with a mix of studios, one-bedroom, and two-bedroom units. Finally, more office vacancies are coming. Could more office to residential conversions be on the way? Opportunities abound. An estimated 12,000 people now live downtown, where residential development now far outstrips office and commercial projects. Office vacancies have grown as Wells Fargo has shifted most of its downtown workers to its Jordan Creek campus in West Des Moines. Meanwhile, the current U.S. courthouse on the east bank of the Des Moines River is slated for auction as the courts prepare to move to the soon-to-be-completed new courts building on the west bank. In addition, the city is planning to move police headquarters and city departments housed in the Argonne Armory building, also on the east bank, to an office building it purchased from Nationwide Mutual Insurance on Locust Street and renamed the T.M. Franklin County City Administration Building for former Mayor Frank County. Plans for the historic structures have yet to be announced.
Ex-Eldora staffer to be paid $60,000. He had a sexual relationship with the then superintendent at the state training school at Eldora and was the victim of sexual harassment and retaliation. The Iowa Board of Appeals agreed to pay the settlement to Jacob Manship, 49, of Union, who alleges he was forced to resign from the residential home for delinquent youth in February 2022. Manship alleged in a civil lawsuit filed in March 2023 against the state and the school that while employed there, he suffered quid pro quo sexual harassment by then-superintendent Wendy Leiker, who resigned in August 2022 after just 11 months on the job. Iowa Department of Health and Human Services officials said at the time that Leiker resigned voluntarily during a confidential personnel investigation. Leiker could not be reached Tuesday for comment. In its answer to Manship's lawsuit, a lawyer for the Iowa Attorney General's office denied Leiker sexually harassed Manship, but did acknowledge the two had a sexual relationship and that she promoted him. The state also denied that Leiker offered Manship the promotion in 2021 in exchange for sex acts, and that she gave him a disproportionate and unmanageable workload when he tried to break off the relationship. In the lawsuit, also alleging defamation of character, tortious interference, and intentional infliction of emotional distress, Manship alleged he reported the sexual harassment internally to his immediate supervisor, Larry Cranston. He also alleges he was harassed by coworkers who blamed him for Leiker's resignation, which the state denied. The settlement, which includes $5,000 for Manship's wife and $20,000 for his attorneys, comes just over a month after Leiker's replacement as superintendent, Jason Sodders, was fired along with the deputy superintendent and treatment program administrator at the school following an investigation into allegations that a counselor had an inappropriate relationship and phone sex with a delinquent boy. The school also has been under federal court monitoring for years to improve treatment of youth in its care. Despite much training, hiring, renovations, new spending, and a shrinking population at the facility, however, allegations of sexual abuse and harassment by staff and students have continued. Federal audit reports obtained this year under the Open Records Law showed. Manship filed a complaint with the Iowa Civil Rights Commission in January 2022. He took leave under the Family Medical Leave Act and then resigned the same month. Later, he alleged, two job offers he had received from state prisons in Mitchellville and Newton were rescinded after Sodders contacted the prisons. The state denied, Sodders intervened. Mr. Sodders also sent an email to all state training school employees, which indicated that Jacob was banned from the premises, and directed STS employees and switchboard to take action in the event that Jacob was seen on the campus, the lawsuit says. The Iowa Civil Rights Commission deemed Manship's complaints of sexual harassment, retaliation, and discrimination worthy of further investigation, but the state appeal board declined to act on his tort claim within 6 months, so he brought it to district court, his suit says.
A judge says that West Des Moines' canceling of a contract after inflammatory emails was not retaliation. A security provider who sued West Des Moines for retaliation after it canceled its contract with him following a Des Moines Register report about incendiary emails he wrote cannot show he was wronged by city officials, a federal judge ruled. Security firm Conley Group Incorporated provided armed security services for both West Des Moines and Des Moines until 2021, when West Des Moines canceled its contract and the company mutually agreed to end its contract with Des Moines. Those actions came after the Register reported on emails that company president and CEO Tom Connolly sent to police and city officials, including Des Moines Police Chief Dana Wingert. The emails accused Des Moines Black Liberation Movement demonstrators of what it called terrorism and shared memes mocking George Floyd, LGBT people, and racial justice protesters. Connolly and Connolly Group sued West Des Moines in 2023, accusing the city of unlawful retaliation against him for protected free speech and defamation. He also accused Councilmember Renee Hardman of contract interference for improperly urging Des Moines City Manager Scott Sanders to cancel that city's contract with Connolly Group. The city asked the court to dismiss the suit, arguing none of Connolly's claims are legally viable. On Monday, Federal Chief Judge Stephanie Rose agreed, ordering all of Connolly's claims dismissed. Mike Richards, an attorney for the city, praised the order, calling it in an email to the Register a, quote, thoughtful and well-reasoned decision, end quote. Attorney Ken Monroe, representing Connolly, declined to comment beyond saying Connolly intends to appeal. Connolly claimed that by ending his contract in response to the publication of his emails, West Des Moines was retaliating against him in violation of his First Amendment right to free speech. The problem, Rose wrote, is that Connolly, the person, and Connolly Group, Inc., the company, are different entities. Connolly, she wrote, appears from court filings to have been acting as an individual rather than on behalf of his company when he sent the objectionable emails. West Des Moines' action in ending the contract only legally affected Connolly Group. Despite being the company's sole owner and shareholder, Rose found, Connolly lacks standing for his First Amendment claim because he has not suffered any legal injury distinct from his company. Connolly also accused the city of what he called defamation by implication, meaning the city juxtaposed facts or omitted context to create the impression that he, as he put it in his complaint, was a racist. But Rose pointed out in her order that Connolly does not, in court filings, identify any specific statements made by city officials, direct or indirect, that support his case, and that he instead suggests that the city's actions related to his company's contract amount to defamation. This is not a proper basis for a defamation claim, Rose wrote. As for what she called torturous interference with business contacts, Rose wrote that the one example Connolly gave, that quote rather, the torturous interference with business contracts, was a quote from Connolly's filings. Rose wrote in reference to them that the one example Connolly gave of Hartman allegedly contacting Des Moines officials to demand the city also cancel its Connolly contract also is inadequate to support his claim. A litigant must not only show that another party improperly interfered in their contract, but that the interference was the cause of the resulting damage, Rose wrote. She found that Connolly failed to explain how Hardman's alleged actions caused Des Moines to terminate his contract, and in fact admits that he voluntarily ended that contract himself, meaning that he falls far short of establishing a contract interference claim. Prior to the Register's 2021 reporting, Connolly Group had security contracts at both the Des Moines and West Des Moines City Halls, as well as in the Des Moines Skywalk. It is unclear the company is still contracting to provide security to any metro cities. Connolly has said in court filings he was planning to sell the security portion of his business in the summer of 2021. One reason, he said, he voluntarily chose to end the contract with Des Moines to avoid further controversy. But the company's website still lists armed security as one of its services and Connolly as its president and CEO.
Well, that concludes the metro section. Going back to the main section, House passes long-term funding bill. The bipartisan measure to avoid shutdown expected to clear in the Senate. The House passed the first six spending bills needed to fund the government on a long-term basis, signaling the beginning of the end of constant government shutdown scares on Capitol Hill. The legislation easily cleared the lower chamber by a bipartisan vote of 339-85. In what has become a familiar instance, far more Democrats than Republicans supported the bill, despite the GOP's majority in the lower chamber. A chunk of House Republicans voted against the spending bill because it didn't have many of the conservative policy wins some members wanted, such as stricter border policies. White House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, and other GOP leaders sought to sell the victories they got. Any final long-term spending bill ultimately would not have been able to satisfy conservatives. With a Democrat-controlled Senate, President Joe Biden in the White House, and the GOP's razor-thin House majority, Republicans never had much leverage to get everything they wanted. We want to cut spending. We want to limit the size and scope of the federal government. The reality right now is we have divided government, Johnson said Wednesday. The bill now heads to the Senate, where it is also expected to pass. Each year, Congress has to pass 12 individual spending bills to keep the government's doors open. Recently, lawmakers have failed to meet their spending deadlines, so they tend to package the dozen bills into an enormous piece of legislation called an omnibus. The first six of those spending bills are set to expire on March 8th. So to avoid a partial government shutdown, negotiators packaged the funding into one deal known as a minibus. The plan passed Wednesday will fund parts of the government related to agriculture, rural development, the Food and Drug Administration, commerce, justice, science, energy, water development, the interior, military construction, veterans affairs, transportation, housing, and urban development. The real test for Congress, however, is passing the remaining six bills, which are considered to be far more controversial than the first. Negotiators have until March 22nd to come up with a long-term deal for government funding for functions related to defense, financial services, general government, homeland security, labor, health and human services, education, the legislative branch, the State Department, and foreign operations. Though the final product passed on Wednesday was a bipartisan compromise, both Republican and Democratic lawmakers claimed their own victories from the spending package. House Republicans were able to secure protections for gun rights for military veterans who have been deemed unable to manage their own veteran affairs benefits. The policy add-on was a major sticking point in negotiations with Democratic lawmakers who support stricter gun control legislation, raising concerns. Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut, said in a Wednesday morning post on X that he would vote against the minibus due to the policy provision, which could result in 20,000 new seriously mentally ill individuals being able to buy guns each year. Along with the gun policy rider, Johnson touted spending cuts to the Department of Justice, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the FBI, and the Environmental Protection Agency, among others. On the other hand, Democrats managed to secure an additional $1 billion in funding for the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, or WIC. Increased WIC funding was an intense point of contention between negotiators. In a significant victory for abortion rights advocates, Democrats also blocked an effort from Republicans to restrict access to abortion pills. I'm really excited about the bills that we're going to deal with today because it's nowhere near the 22% cuts that the House Republicans had threatened, Representative Rosa DeLauro, Democrat of Connecticut, the top Democrat on the House Appropriations Committee, said at a news conference Wednesday. In an unsurprising reaction, Johnson faced severe blowback from his right flank over the bill passed on Wednesday. Hard right officials said the plan did not contain enough spending cuts or major conservative policy wins. Ultra-conservative members also railed against the return of earmarks in the spending bills and a lack of changes to border and migrant policy. Representative Chip Roy, Republican of Texas, a member of the House Freedom Caucus, said in a post on X that the bill is littered with earmarks, fails to secure the border, and punts almost every GOP policy win. Freedom Caucus Chair Bob Good, Republican of Virginia, argued to reporters on Tuesday that when we have one House, we ought to get half of our wins. When pressed about the inevitable need for Democratic votes in a divided government, Good, visibly frustrated, abruptly ended the conversation. Representative Ralph Norman, Republican of South Carolina, another member of the Freedom Caucus, said Johnson should have threatened a partial government shutdown to secure changes to border and migrant policy. Will Johnson will face repercussions for not acquiescing to conservative demands, such as the threat of removing him from his leadership post? When asked, Norman responded, "Who knows?"
The 2024 matchup is the same and different from the 2020 matchup. This is an analysis piece from USA Today. Barring asteroids hitting the Earth before then, the presidential ballot in November is set to feature Joe Biden versus Donald Trump again. With Super Tuesday over, the rematch almost no one wanted now seems all but certain. Trump's near sweep of GOP contests in 15 states and one territory, Nikki Haley won only Vermont, then dropped out Wednesday, put him within striking distance of enough Republican National Convention delegates to clinch the nomination. Biden's State of the Union address Thursday will launch his election year agenda, with the preservation of democratic institutions once again the heart of his message. That all sounds familiar enough, but the 2024 campaign is not simply a rerun of the original version 4 years ago. Changes in the candidates and the world are defining a different political landscape and creating new challenges, especially for Biden. In his victory speech at Mar-a-Lago, Trump called Biden the worst president in the history of our country and added, November 5, it's right around the corner. In his written statement, Biden focused on the general election, too. Today, millions of voters across the country made their voices heard, he said, showing that they are ready to fight back against Donald Trump's extreme plan to take us backwards, Biden's statement said. In recent months, the current president has begun lagging the previous one in national and swing state polls. So what is different in 2024? In 2020, Trump was the incumbent and Biden the challenger, with the freedom to criticize his opponent's record without having to defend his own. Consider immigration. Trump used heated rhetoric to warn of the dangers of migrants and instituted harsh and controversial policies, including separating families at the border. In the 2020 campaign, Biden promised a more humane approach that would be consistent with America's aspirational values. Now, as the current resident of the White House, Biden owns the surging problems at the southern border. In recent weeks, he has begun calling a record flood of asylum seekers there a border crisis and endorsed legislation that could close the border at times and expedite deportations. He no longer mentions an early priority to create a pathway to citizenship for so-called dreamers, those brought to the U.S. illegally as children. Securing the border and controlling immigration gives Trump the biggest issue advantage over Biden, according to an NBC News poll taken in January. Those surveyed said by a yawning 35 percentage points that Trump would be better at handling it than Biden. Next, foreign policy. In 2020, Biden emphasized his foreign policy experience while depicting Trump as a peril to U.S. alliances and interests in the world. But the botched withdrawal of the U.S. forces from Afghanistan in 2021, costing 13 U.S. service members their lives, shook the image of him as a steady leader. Now in the Mideast, his support of Israel's military response to Hamas's brutal attack 6 months ago has divided the Democratic Party and prompted protesters to disrupt events by Biden, First Lady Jill Biden, and Vice President Kamala Harris. Advocates had urged Democrats to vote uncommitted to show their dissatisfaction with Biden's policy toward Gaza. On Tuesday, uncommitted received nearly 19% of the Democratic primary vote in Minnesota and about 8% in Colorado. It also received just over 13% in an earlier primary in Michigan. Meanwhile, Trump has stayed largely silent about the conflict and its solutions, a privilege of challengers. And reminding you that this is analysis by U.S. Today. Today we'll conclude with the comment that we're all older now. Republicans spotlight every stumble by Biden, who is 81, as evidence that he lacks the mental and physical acuity to serve as president. Democrats note that Trump, just 4 years younger at 77, is making missteps of his own, including confusing Nikki Haley with Nancy Pelosi and referring to Barack Obama as the current president. That's an issue for Trump to some degree. In North Carolina, 1 in 5 Republican primary voters said he did not have the physical and mental health to be the president. 3/4 said that he did. For Biden, the issue is more troublesome. He already became the oldest president in U.S. history when he won in 2020 at age 78, though his age was not a dominant issue then. 4 years later, it is, according to this analysis by USA Today, who claims that the 24 matchup is the same and different from the 2020 matchup.